From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Sarah Baldwin. This week, a slightly different take on international affairs.
Loss opens up a place of anger and longing and blame, and they work hand in hand.
The voice you just heard was Pamela Petro. She's a writer, teacher, and artist whose otherworldly photographs are currently on exhibit at Watson. They capture different locations around the world at dusk and look more like abstract paintings than something you'd see in National Geographic. Like much of her work, they explore ideas of time, memory, and loss. They also explore the culture and history of Wales, her second home, and geographic muse. At a moment when it feels like there's an endless stream of breaking news that we can't avoid, it's worth stepping back and thinking about things on a longer timescale. That's what we did in this episode. And while we still found our way to the present, hopefully hearing Pam's take on these things will help you see it all from a new angle. Pam Petro, it is so nice to have you in talking with us today.
Sarah, it is so wonderful to be here, truly.
I'm going to try something.
Okay.
Hiraith.
You did it right.
Is that right?
You did it right.
Hiraith.
Hiraith.
I've been practicing.
You are maybe one of the few people who nailed that.
Woo!
On the first go.
Well, you wrote it out so clearly in its phonetic way. So Hiraith has been, for so many years, your source of inquiry, investigation, inspiration.
All of those.
I wonder if you could explain this notion for which we really don't have an English equivalent.
Certainly. I'll give it my best try. Hiraith is a Welsh word. Hir and aith put together means long field. And it's an old Welsh word. It goes back, I think the first recording of it, maybe the 11th or 12th century, but it probably goes back much longer than that. And technically, it has one cognate of all the world's 7,000 languages, which is the Portuguese saudade. That was the Brazilian pronunciation.
That was beautiful.
Thank you. I have a Brazilian partner. So both mean the same thing, essentially in the most compact crystalline form, the presence of absence.
The presence of absence. You've also said a bone-deep longing for an irretrievable elsewhere and acute awareness of the presence of absence. Those are so beautiful.
Thank you. When it's translated from the Welsh, it's translated as a deep longing or homesickness.
Mm-hmm.
But that just touches the surface, and then you have to investigate what home means.
Mm-hmm.
And that can go off in so many different directions. So I tell people at its core, it's a longing for something, for someone, for some place. Often it's place-based, that you can't get back to, you can't have, you can never get to again, or you'll never be able to inhabit, even in your imagination, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's something you've perhaps idealized from the past that you're still looking for in the real world,
mm-hmm.
but that you, part of you is aware that you'll never find.
But it lives on in you. It's not a feeling that goes away.
It never goes away. You can be longing in Wales. It's a longing for Wales that you feel most strongly in Wales.
What made you go to Wales? You were a student at Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And what made you go to Wales for graduate school?
At Brown, I had put together an independent concentration in writing and illustration with a lot of courses at RISD. And just before I graduated, I saw in List Art Building the ugliest poster I'd ever seen for an MA at the University of Wales called The Word and the Visual Imagination in Word and Image Studies. And I thought, I need to go there.
Wow. And was that your first time in Wales?
That was my first time in Wales.
And you learned the language?
Many years later, I went back. I counted the other day, I think I've been to Wales 28 times in 37 years.
That's amazing.
Something like that. I wouldn't, I'd say I've tried to learn the language. I speak it really haltingly.
Well, it's a difficult language because it doesn't look the way it sounds in my
Actually, when you learn the alphabet in Welsh, then it absolutely cleaves to that. It's not like English. Everything is pronounced. W is a vowel. I'm going to say that as a public service to the world.
W is a vowel.
Yes. People say, oh, it's so many consonants.
You went to Wales as a graduate student. How do we end up feeling hiraeth about a place that hasn't been ours forever?
Fantastic question. And there's another word that I'll tell you, and I think that describes it because it lays the groundwork for hiraeth. Cynefin. Cynefin is another Welsh word that means initially a sheep teaching her lamb what part of the mountain is hers, is home. So I think that's where that idea of an animal loving its home comes from. But Cynefin also means, Cynefin is a liminal space between an imagined interior and the exterior environment. So what it does, it means you go to a place for the first time and it looks like an interior landscape that you've known all your life. So I went to Wales and saw the landscape and saw the rolling hills, and it made such sense to me. It was this place I'd seen in my mind's eye all my life, and I knew that place would be right, and I got to Wales and there it was.
Could you do us a great favor and read just a few lines about what you were looking at?
Certainly.
If you would.
It soon became chilly, but the ground held on to its warmth so that the hills began to smoke with eddying bands of mist. That dusk was unspeakably beautiful and not a little illicit. It seemed, for a millisecond, as if I were witnessing the earth drop its guard and exhale its love for the sky, for the pungent cattle, the rabbits whose bones lay underfoot, and for me, too. I felt that. And once you feel that, the ground is laid for hiraeth, because it sort of bores a hole inside you. And when, from that moment on, you always want to be connected to this place. And you aren't always, and maybe you'll never feel that again. But that love lives inside that hole, but it's still a hole.
Mm-hmm.
And it meant so much to me that Welsh had a word to describe that. And I thought, this is a heck of a place. Not only did it give me the landscape, it gave me a word to describe my connection to this landscape.
To describe it, to validate it in a way.
To validate it. And I think it also is what the dusk images do in the show. They also occupy that liminal space between, at dusk, what you imagine you see around you and what you do see. So they kind of, in my mind, are emblems of Cynefin.
Let's talk a little bit about the exhibition. You have an exhibition here at the Watson Institute of photographs called The Blink of Our Lifetimes, The Ecology of Dusk. And I'm thinking of all our listeners who can't come because they're all over the world, or they're not in Providence anyway. And
come people, to Providence.
Yes. First of all, yes. But how would you just describe what someone would see, what they're looking at when they enter your exhibition?
Okay. I would say the first thing is it's a big white space, and these are bursts of color in that space. Imagine a blurred photograph, and that's what this begins with and attempts to take further, to find the beauty in a moved camera image that looks for instability rather than stability, takes a point of color or light in an otherwise dark, dusky space and pulls it into that darkness. So it becomes a streak, like a plane trail. But imagine plane trails of color. There's one image I'm thinking of a tall oak tree surrounded by a darkening blue sky. And the oak tree is encircled by a very red vine in October. And there's a yellow tree beside it. And I moved the camera up and down when I was, after I had framed that tree in the viewfinder. And the result is just a rush of red and a bit of yellow in the corner and an almost electric blue sky in the background. So it gives you an impression rather than prints a particular image or a particular moment in your mind's eye.
But it feels like, and side note, it can be seen on our website.
Uh-huh.
It feels, you know, you're looking at nature. Mm. You know, you're looking not at a human landscape, but a humanless landscape in a way.
It's not so removed or so abstract that you can't imagine your way back to the roots of the image. And I think that's exactly what I'm trying to do, that dusk is a moment where seer and seen blend, I say, because some things are obscured and you must imagine them, but some things are still there and you must look harder to see them on their own terms. So when you're looking at the exhibition, some images are more abstracted than others, but I think through the colors and through the shapes, you can work your way back and say, it must have been this, or maybe it's that. And I want to leave that space so everybody has their own place to imagine or remember.
Well, I want to talk about that liminality for a second. You work in words and images, shadows and light, color and blackness, day and night, interiority and the natural world, immensity and tininess, stillness and motion, ephemerality and timelessness, coincidence and meaning. And at Brown, as you mentioned, you even did that, you invented your own concentration in writing and illustration. And so can you talk about how these opposites sort of find expression in your work? What are they doing in your work, and how are you contending with them, and how do they speak to each other?
Wow, that's a great question that I haven't thought about. Everything in my life comes back to the Far Side cartoon.
And it does?
Yes. There's a Far Side for everything.
I did not know that.
There's a great Far Side cartoon of a Y in the path. And one side says the beaten path and the other says off. And this couple is looking at both. And I think one of them starts off down the off path and the other says, I don't think that's a good idea. And I think my life is constantly following the beaten path to a point, but then there's always a junction. And part of me is always saying, you need to not contradict this, but explore the opposite of this. It's in my nature to do that.
And I wonder, how do you know when to photograph and when to write?
I don't think there's any way to codify that. An example is one of the truly great honors in my life was to be one of the artists in residence at the Grand Canyon. And that was an example of coming as probably both a word and image artist, but mainly for the images, and looking out into the canyon and thinking about seeing the shadows of the cast by the enormous eroded formations. And everything I did there sort of focused around those formations and the shadows. And I thought in images first, but why? I'm not sure. I think in that case, maybe it was experiential. I was there as an artist looking, and so seeing and images took precedence. But this Wales book, say, is based in memory.
The forthcoming one. Let's talk about that. Can you say the title?
Certainly. It's called The Long Field, A Memoir, Wales, and the Presence of Absence.
So what are you doing in this book?
This book is an investigation of the idea of hiraeth. It's trying to bring hiraeth to an English-speaking audience. It's been said in Wales that hiraeth is both quintessentially Welsh and a universal human experience, but we don't have a word for it. It's much, much stronger than nostalgia or longing or homesickness. So I investigate how hiraeth has emerged in Wales, as Wales being the first colony of the English Empire in the beginning of the 13th century. So I give examples from history. I give examples out of Welsh literature, like the disappearance of the scape around the Magic Mound. And I then universalize it and see and investigate, take hiraeth in ways that I don't think it's ever been taken. The hiraeth of technology, the hiraeth of sexuality. Hiraeth in Wales has traditionally been related to love, to home, and to God. So this is taking it in new ways. I thought that would be the book initially, and then my agent response pushed me into, well, why don't you're talking about this in national and emotional terms, collective terms, but you're not applying it personally. You're saying it's personal, but you're not writing personally. And so over the next 5 years or so, I started writing about myself. So the book is braided. It's about Wales and about me and how we intersect and how we both demonstrate hiraeth.
Can I ask you, you write about the Englishman George Borrow.
Oh, yeah.
Borrow?
Borrow.
Borrow.
Yes.
You write of him that he, like you, was seduced into selective marginality by the Welsh landscape.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean by that? Is that sort of more the personal?
Yeah, I thought a lot about that. Borrow was a mid-19th century Victorian writer who's very English in some ways, but he was drawn to marginal groups. He wrote a lot about the what they called then the gypsies, the Romany speakers throughout Europe, in Britain as well. And he was drawn to Wales. Which he saw as representing a living instance of the past and also a marginal language, a marginal culture within within the Isle of Great Britain. And I think I wrote in my first book on Wales, Travels in an Old Tongue, when I traveled around the world trying to speak Welsh, there's a moment when it hit me that being American was almost to be absent of identity because America, the land, was everywhere, and America also incorporated everywhere into it. So where was my identity within that? So to selectively choose one of the most marginal places I could find, I think spoke to this longing in me to have a particularity of expression, of roots. And also, I think that may reflect my upbringing during the Vietnam War and Watergate, being off-center as a generational choice, and also being a gay woman. I think that also has, it's represented in a feeling of affinity with marginal place.
I hesitate to leave this sublime space of your work, but I wondered if hiraeth connects to contemporary politics, because I can imagine that there's a less positive nostalgia can be used in many ways.
I knew you had to go here, Sarah. I knew you did. And it wouldn't be right not to. I will say, as just a quick prelude to the answer, that a lot of my friends in Wales have said to me for years now, why are you writing about hiraeth? We hate hiraeth. I see it. What I haven't said yet, can I say this too?
Yeah.
Is that this longing, this incompleteness that we all have in our lives for people, for places, whatever, is an incredibly generative longing that there are, I think, what separates hiraeth from nostalgia and commonplace homesickness is that we have to create.
Right. You talk about compensatory creativity
that fills the long field mm-hmm. of absence. Mm-hmm. The tales, the wonder tales of the Mabinogion, they imagine a time of glory for Wales written at a time of colonization. And what lasted, but those tales lasted. The creative mind at work in those tales is still with us. There are all kinds of examples in Wales of creative, what I call creative hiraeth. I think it's the great engine that runs Welsh culture, personally. A region lost to the sea years ago in Neolithic times, off Aberdyfi, the coast of Aberdyfi in Wales. People still say they hear the bells ringing in the chapels. But this idea of hiraeth as looking back to a time that has been or never was, a glorified time of the past, and then having a politician come along to say, I can take you back there, but I can take some of us back there, and other people are responsible for us having drifted away from this time. Well, that to me is what President Trump has done. I find that reflex of hiraeth that separates people into groups, that glorifies a past of choice for particular groups. The hiraeth impulse and reflex all too readily lends itself to that. And I think that's the same kind of compensatory reflex that's also behind Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
And they work hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, they're very infused with the sense of loss.
Exactly. And I think it was Mary Oliver said, loss is the beginning of everything. Loss is, which is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But loss also opens up a place of anger and longing and retribution and blame. So you have to be very careful.
Mm-hmm. And a desire to reclaim.
To reclaim what?
To avenge.
And to reinvent in one group's own image. And that is destructive, I find.
Oh, that was such a good answer, but I don't want to end on that. Just see if,
let me see if I can. But you know what I can tell you? I can tell you something. All the Celtic languages, and so Welsh, don't form the verb to have. You can't. English is incredibly possessive in that it has the construction to have. I have a car. It is my car. It exists in a timeless construction in the sentence. I have a car. There's no future. There's no past. I just have it. It's mine. In Welsh, you cannot say that. There's no construction to say it. You have to say, my car gyda fi. There is a car with me.
Oh, I love that so much.
It gives the car agency, and it creates a relationship between you and the car. And all relationships are governed by time. So it's maybe the car will leave, maybe you will leave. What? Something will happen, and you will not always be together. This is a construction in I think, most or all Celtic languages, but I also see it as the heart of the hiraeth impulse that only Welsh went on to create the word, and the emotion that goes with the knowledge that relationships end between people, between things, between people and places.
And that loss is the beginning of something creative.
Exactly.
Well, Pam, what a delight to talk to you today. Thank you so much for sharing all these thoughts with us.
Oh, Sarah, it has been my pleasure, and thank you for asking the great questions.
I hope you'll come back.
I'd love to.
Thanks. This episode of Trending Globally was produced by Dan Richards and Jackson Cantrell. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. I'm Sarah Baldwin. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps others find the show. For more information about this and other shows, go to watson.brown.edu. Thanks for listening, and tune in 2 weeks for another episode of Trending Globally.